Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
Traditionally, all the controversies of the early church have been taken to be about dogmas, ideas of the sort, or perhaps practices to some extent. Within the Christian church. But the angle with which I began to approach this topic was really a more social one, that I thought you probably could explain a good many features of this controversy with very little recourse to theology.
First of all, Crusader art is hard to recognize. If you don't go out to the Holy Land and look at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre or at Croc de Chevalier, the great castles of the Crusaders, what you're going to find when you go to Europe, you'll have to seek out.
Early Christian social history and the art of the Crusaders in the Holy Land, this week on Soundings. First, a conversation with Elizabeth Clark of Duke University. Following that, Yaroslav Folda of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill discusses his history of Crusader art. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Elizabeth Clark worked on a social history of the originist controversy, the principal religious debate of late 4th and early 5th century Christendom. Here is Elizabeth Clark.
Well, how this happened was in the very closing year or two of the 4th century. The Church Father Jerome translated into Latin a famous book of Christian theology that Origen had written more than 150 years earlier that's called On First Principles. And when this Latin translation became circulated in Rome and other places, an enormous furor erupted because it seemed to many people that the doctrines that were espoused in it were not orthodox.
Are we talking about what the resurrection, the incarnation, really big Christian themes,
yes,
or nitpicking kinds of things?
No, I would say they were really big Christian themes. For example, at the time that Origen wrote, the doctrine of the Trinity, as it has been expressed for many centuries in the Christian church, was not yet entirely formulated. Hmm. And in Origen's theology, there's a very definite tendency to subordinate the Son, or what Christians would come to call the second person of the Trinity, to God the Father. Now, by the time you get to the year 400, there's been enormous theological controversy about all that that raged throughout the better part of the 4th century, and it now is no longer considered orthodox to say that the Son is less than the Father, and the Father is the greatest or dominant person within the Trinity.
We're moving toward this notion of three separate, equal, combined, unified entities. We got that right?
Yes, as you'd say, the orthodox formulation is that at least by about 381, the definitive stamp had been put on the teaching that you were supposed to say that there is one essence or one nature of the Godhood and three persons of the Godhood. So that was one kind of element in Origen's theology that was criticized. Origen also taught in several places in his works that the original creation had not been of bodies, that all of us existed as pure disembodied minds in the heavens above.
That sounds very Platonic.
Yes, indeed. A lot of this theology comes right out of late ancient Platonism. There's no doubt about that. And because these minds either got lazy, said Origen, or slothful, perhaps, they ceased to contemplate God with the ardor they were supposed to.
And what, fell into the material world.
And the bodies were then created to house these minds, which fell, and as they fell, they cooled off, so said Origen.
Oh, goodness.
And acquired these dense, gross bodies that we walk around in. And that of course, then related to his doctrine of what happens at the end of things. He thought that instead of affirming what many Christians wanted to, namely a physical resurrection of the body, Origen said, we will cast off our bodies again and become pure disembodied minds as we were at the beginning.
You pointed out to me before our conversation that there were women involved in this controversy, and that's an important dimension in your study. Are we on the right track there?
Yes, indeed. That, in fact, it's one of the few controversies in the early church where women did play a fairly active role. And in fact, that's how I first got into the study of the controversy. For about the past 10 years, I have been working on women in the early Christian movement, particularly women in the later 4th and early 5th century who were founders of monasteries and so forth.
Well, let's pursue this role of women. Was it the role of women important because they were women or because of the ideas that they had? Do we need to make some distinctions
there? I'd probably say neither. They became important and became written about, which was the only way we would know about them, of course. Because they had a great deal of money, and because they were in circumstances where they could use that money for the benefit of the Christian church and for the support of the people carrying on these controversies, such as the Originist controversy I'm dealing with.
Tell me, Liz Clark, about some of the characters, the figures that you treat. You've mentioned some names, and again, you know, they're not household sorts of names, and I don't want merely a chronology, but, you know, be anecdotal for me. Tell me a story or two about these characters who were involved in this controversy.
All right. I'll tell you a little about, say, Melania the Elder. She was a woman who became attached, in an ascetic sense, of course, to one of the leaders of this controversy, Rufinus. That she was a very wealthy woman originally from Spain, who had settled in Rome with her husband. She had three children, two of whom died, and her husband died all at once, leaving one son. She, we are told in the stories written about her that she thanked God for relieving her of such a great burden, meaning her children and her husband, and took her then enormous fortune and went off to see the Desert Fathers in Egypt and then to Palestine, where she and Rufinus built monasteries on the Mount of Olives outside Jerusalem. And from there, she entertained great hordes of visiting monks, priests, bishops, etc., who were coming through, and also supported some of the monks who were occasionally under persecution, that we know a series of episodes that's really part of the Trinitarian controversy of the 4th century, in which the nature of the Trinity, right, in which some monks were driven out of Egypt, and she supported them basically from her own income in Palestine for a period of years. So we have women like that. In terms of the men in the controversy, the person I've been working on this year particularly is somebody that I suppose is even less of a household word than Origen is, namely someone named Evagrius Ponticus, who came originally from Asia Minor and spent the last 15 years of his life in the Egyptian desert and wrote what became really the theory of asceticism that came into Christian theology, that we know now things we didn't know even 50 years ago, that the development of Western asceticism and monasticism is very much rooted in some kind of the concepts that he developed. For example, in the Middle Ages, you have the notion of the seven deadly sins. Mm-hmm. This really comes out of Evagrius. When I first encountered this material, I think probably had the same attitude to it that I see some of my undergraduate students have when they first encounter it. They giggle and they think it's embarrassing.
Something
that people
weird.
Thought that's very strange.
Yeah.
And the ideas about marriage and reproduction that are involved in this sexuality, et cetera. It's very foreign from the way most people in 20th century America think about these issues. But the more I began to put the ascetic movements together with what was going on with women in later antiquity, the more I began to see that asceticism was a very powerful force. It would perhaps be too trendy in 20th century to say it was a force for women's liberation, but I think it certainly did work that way. If you were of a woman, particularly if you were of a certain class, that is, with enough money to be able to, say, found monasteries, enter them. This was the only alternative to marriage, of course, in this period. And for women who liked a life that would involve a more scholarly, contemplative approach, this was really the only alternative to marriage and childbearing.
Can we attach a word like education this function of asceticism?
I think so, in that although the women on whom I've worked, because they came from the very highest classes of the aristocracy, tended to receive much better educations than lower class women of their day would, that the women would be educated, if not quite equally, with their male siblings, that nonetheless they received quite a high degree of education. But then the monasteries they founded would often provide some kind of educational means for women to study, to read books, and so on.
Well, now the money would remove them. Would the aestheticism, the education, remove them even further from the society, from the social circumstances?
I think so. That it was.
Was that a good thing or a bad thing?
I'm asking. I think it was a good thing, even though for many of them it was very class based, and I certainly have to acknowledge that. And that it meant it was a way of breaking free of the confines of societal restraint or constraint. When you think that basically what these women's function in life was, if they came from a certain class of the aristocracy, was to be married off, most of them when they were very young. A number of these women were married by their parents when they were 13 or 14 years old, and they were to have children. and it has to do with the transfer of property and inheritance. And when I say property, we are talking about people who had estates in 10 or 12 provinces of the Roman Empire. For example, we have Melania the Younger, the granddaughter of Melania the Elder. And we know that she had property in a number of provinces, maybe about 10 provinces of the Roman Empire.
Here we're touching on politics.
Yes indeed. The money of the highest level of the aristocracy in the Roman Empire came from landed estates, which were worked by hundreds and hundreds of slaves. We read about Melania the Younger, for example, that on one estate alone she freed 8,000 of her slaves.
Goodness.
This is almost incomprehensible to the American imagination today. There have been some recent attempts to translate, you might say, into contemporary American dollars the amount of money these people would have had at their disposal.
Give me an idea.
Well, one of my colleagues here at the center said, well, there's no good way to do these translations from ancient sums of money, but using the best kind of equivalents we can, Melania the Younger, we know, would have had an annual income. Now, this is income, not property or anything else. An annual income of about $123 million a year.
Oh, my goodness.
So when we're talking about wealth and the power that wealth conveys and what these women were up to, you can see how it was very important to their parents and relatives to be able to control these women's bodies, their reproductive lives, to make sure they married appropriate men, had children, and so forth.
And this would have repercussions also in the sense of who and what, behind whom and what women such as this would throw their support. And here we're back to the, regardless of gender, the issues of the originist controversy.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. When people with money like that begin to support and take sides in controversies of this kind, you might say, perhaps if there had been no money behind it, the controversy would not have gone on even for as long as it did, which wasn't so many years.
Elizabeth Clark teaches at Duke University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Elizabeth Clark worked on a social history of the originist controversy, the prime religious debate of late 4th and early 5th century Christendom. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with a conversation featuring Yaroslav Folda of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. During his recent fellowship year at the center, Yaroslav Folda worked on a history of the art of the Crusaders in the Holy Land. Here is Yaroslav Folda.
Well, I think the Crusades, first of all, have to be placed chronologically so people know where we are in time. And this means the period from 1095, when the Pope Urban II made his famous speech in Clermont in France, and then the Crusade set forth and miraculously conquered Jerusalem in 1099. The First Crusade goes out there leaves in 1096, takes, believe it or not, 3 years to get there. 1099, July 15th, 1099, the Crusaders stormed the walls of Jerusalem.
We're not talking about Holiday Inns.
We're not talking about, tough going, very few people, relatively speaking, had any idea what it was going to take to march from Central Europe to Constantinople, across Asia Minor, to Antioch, and down the coast.
Goodness.
It was a miracle that the First Crusade actually accomplished the objective of taking Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. It was just a miracle. But in any case, these Crusaders, having taken Jerusalem, suddenly realized that not a great deal of thought had been given to what do we do now. Then it was time to think about, we have to establish ourselves here. And it's in the process of the establishing themselves, and while the establishing was going on, that the whole possibility of Crusader art came up. Because what after all, one of the focus points for the Crusade was to retake the Holy Sepulchre of Jesus. Mm-hmm. When they got there, the Holy Sepulchre was not in the greatest condition, having been rebuilt and destroyed and one thing or other. So the Crusaders had to, first of all, think about establishing some kind of political state, had to do something in terms of setting up the church that would oversee this establishment. They had to talk about food supplies, they had to talk about fortifications, because no sooner were they there than the Egyptians were threatening to take Jerusalem back.
Was the art of the Crusades in that regard, Jerry Fulda, an afterthought? In the sense that people, men, women, happened to be along who would depict what had happened, or was there a patronage system working here? Somebody back home saying, all right, we're going to send, you know, the medieval version of Picasso along on this trip to record what's going on.
Well, I think that's an interesting idea that it was an afterthought. I think to some extent the art of the Crusaders was a direct challenge to what they found. Hmm. I think to some extent the art of the Crusaders had to do with what various portable things they might have brought with them: their own prayer books, their own missals, their own service books. The things they needed that they brought with them from Europe were then now a sort of source for ideas for art. But the key thing was that there were specific sites and specific objects in the Holy Land that they found when they got there that then inspired new responses, new artistic responses. And I'm talking about the holy sites, mm-hmm. the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the decoration of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I'm talking about also very special relics. There were very special and important objects, like, in particular, the relic of the True Cross. Uh-huh. Of all the relics, of all the objects that the Crusaders sought when they went out there, the relic of the True Cross became the kind of ensign. It became the thing which they carried in battle with the army. Also, I think there were things that the Crusaders didn't know they were going to find, which is also rather unusual. When they came to Antioch, for example, the Crusaders discovered how difficult it was going to be to take a major fortified city. I mean, Antioch was a huge city with walls so it was said 400 towers built by Justinian in the 6th century.
Goodness.
When they managed, again, rather miraculously, to take this city, the Crusaders got into very difficult circumstances, and morale was dropping in the face of an epidemic, in the face of Turkish troops which were bearing down on them and all this. And in the midst of this circumstance, a man had a dream that in the Church of St. Peter, the Holy Lance, the lance that had pierced the side of Christ at the crucifixion, could be found.
Uh-huh.
And so he told this dream to the papal legate, a bishop from Le Puy in France, and they went and, in effect, excavated. They went and started digging up the church. I mean, you can imagine the scene. Here they are, what to do. Here comes this army, and they're in there digging up something the guys had a dream about. But they found it. At least they found something. And this idea of visions, this idea of objects, these kinds of inspirations developed as the crusade went along. And then as the crusaders established themselves in Jerusalem and all along the coast, we're talking here about the eastern Mediterranean coast of what is now Syria, Lebanon, and the current state of Israel, and to some extent the part of Jordan that's just on the other side of the Jordan River on the east bank.
Jerry Fulda, in what did the art of the Crusaders consist?
Well, this is sort of easy, because first and foremost, if anybody ever thinks of Crusader art, they think first of architecture. Architecture is what anybody, I think, would tend to come up with if they were challenged with the question, name one monument of Crusader art. They might think, for example, of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, or they might think of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, which was basically the church from the time of Constantine and Justinian, but which the Crusaders then added a huge program of mosaics on the inside of the church. They might think of the Church of the Incarnation, the Church of the Annunciation, we usually call it, at Nazareth. But I think maybe even more than those buildings, one would think of the castles. First of all, we have the architecture, which I was just referring to, but there's also what we might call the non-permanent art, the portable art, art that we could think of even as refugee art. And this art mainly exists not in the Holy Land, not in the Near East at all anymore.
It's museums?
In the museums. It's mainly in Europe.
Right.
Among the things that we have, just last year, 1988, the first object that we can identify as Crusader art was bought by a major American museum in Houston. The Menil Collection has purchased a new icon. We're talking here about portable objects like manuscripts that were illuminated. We're talking about reliquaries. When people made reliquaries, they placed inside of them, like, for example, a small fragment of the True Cross, so that, as you're probably aware, there are many reliquaries of the True Cross. And what we're concerned about in looking at the art of the Crusaders is what the object is in. It's the reliquary itself.
Its context.
Its context. Exactly. I mean, that's where the metal worker, that's where the goldsmith, that's where the special talents of the artist was employed. We think now that one of the ways in which the art of the Crusaders played a very important role, and we're only beginning to learn about this, is that it was the Crusaders in the Holy Land who learned by direct contact with the Byzantines about Byzantine art, and they themselves practiced it, and then some of these portable objects, these manuscripts, these even icons or altarpieces, were brought back to Italy, and it's in this way that objects made their way and were seen by later European artists.
Is this stuff accessible in general popular terms today, Jerry Fulda, when you're talking about Crusader art? What are there books that you go to? How do you reconstruct this stuff?
Part of the problem here is that not only is the art not accessible, and it's hard to recognize what it is. And even more than that, what I'm doing this year in my project here at the center is trying to pull together what we know about this art, because at the moment it really doesn't exist in a book where you can sort of hand it to somebody and say, look at these wonderful things.
You find yourself crusading, as
it were. I find myself out there trying to evangelize, to tell people about this, because it's so interesting and so important in various ways. Art historically, it's important, but it's also important because, after all, for people in the Middle Ages, Jerusalem was one of the most spectacular concepts. But Jerusalem was also a city like perhaps Constantinople that was fabled. It was fabled because there were many pilgrims' accounts of people that had been there, and they describe the special things that they saw, not the works of art that they saw. This is one thing we always wish they told us more about. They don't tell us what the Holy Sepulchre looked like. They only tell us that it was the place of the sepulchre of Jesus. They're only talking about the relics. And this is what makes things difficult today. They were interested in the substance of the relic. We're interested in the way this relic was packaged, if you want to view it this way. And the things that then the package generated, like new manuscripts, new works of sculpture, new decorations that told the stories about what the object or what the site had contained.
You're looking at it on its own terms.
On its own terms, and in terms of what developed out there when the expeditions weren't there. Hmm. How did they develop these Crusader states, the in particular the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem? And how was it possible for the Crusaders to create this art in the context of this very unusual, exciting, dangerous, but remarkable context that was so different from their homeland back in Europe?
Yaroslav Folda is a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Yaroslav Folda worked on a history of the art of the Crusaders in the Holy Land. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 461. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about philosophy, skepticism, and morality. My guest will be David Kopp of the University of California at Davis. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The last week in July and the first week in August mark an anniversary for the United States Customs Service, which began officially during the first week in August 1789. The Muslim New Year, 1410, of the era of the Hegira begins this week. The founding of the first colony in North America occurred at St. John's Harbor in Newfoundland during the first week in August, 1583. In early August 1962, the South African government charged political leader Nelson Mandela with treason and conspiracy. Finally, the last week in July and the first week in August mark birthdays for the English novelist Emily Bronte, the American automotive pioneer Henry Ford, the architect and Revolutionary War officer Pierre Charles L'Enfant, and the American novelist Herman Melville. Emily Bronte was born in 1818, Henry Ford in 1863, Pierre Charles L'Enfant in 1754, and Herman Melville in 1819. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Crusades and Controversies, this week on Soundings. Listen for Elizabeth Clark of Duke University and Yaroslav Folda of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Elizabeth Clark discusses the Originist controversy, the principal religious debate of late 4th and early 5th century Christendom. Yaroslav Folda talks about the art of the Crusaders in the Holy Land. Crusades and Controversies, this week on Soundings.